It was a beautiful day on the countryside, just like today, the sun shining, maybe later spring, because the green weeds start coming out, just the beautiful road and the two friends, a pig and the chicken, just enjoying the day, birds chirping, isn't it wonderful? But all of a sudden, the bliss of the day gets interrupted, and they see someone crying. They got close, a little girl, maybe 5 or 6, shoulder blades jolting up and down, and the tears just running her chubby cheeks. They come to her and said, "Little girl, why are you crying?" She said, "My nanny passed away a couple of days ago, and I'm just very sad." Two friends looked at each other and said, "Well, little girl, what can we do to make you feel better?" She says, "You know, my grandma used to make me the best breakfast in the world that always made me feel happy." "Yes, little girl, maybe we can help you with that. Yeah, she used to make for me bacon and eggs." The chicken said, "Sure." And look at the pig. And the pig said, "It's easy for you to say. For you, it's a love offering. For me, it's a major sacrifice." I suppose there's some benefit of preaching on April's Fool Day. But I have to warn you, if you're planning to take, at some point in life, a position at the White House, you have to be careful. Because I'm Russian. That joke went better than I thought it would. So preaching on April's Fool Day, it gives me certain freedom and not everything like one of my professors used to say. He walked in the class, he says, "Everything I tell you, 80% is truth and 20% is not. The problem is I just don't know which 20% it is." So on April's Fool Day, there's something freeing. And I know that maybe that's why Pastor Chris switched with me and asked me to preach on April's Fool's Day. I don't know. Whatever it is, don't thank me, thank her. Today's text continues our sermon series, The Sounds of the Cross. In a few days, we're going to walk this path that leads toward the final days of Jesus. But today's story is really about the major sacrifice, a foolish sacrifice. In the passage you have heard, Peter takes the bullet for the team. "Get behind me, Satan." Satan. Why? It is not Peter who seems to be foolish. It is not Peter that seems to be foolish. Isn't that a bit too much? His intentions are really, really good. Because Peter is really concerned about his people. He concerns about his spiritual leader. That road is paved. Peter's road is paved is really with good intentions. A familiar path, isn't it? Why such a visceral reaction on the part of Jesus? It is clear that Jesus has in mind a different kind of avenue which he wants to take. You and I know that Peter is actually right. Peter is making sense. The path that Jesus has in mind doesn't. Who can blame Peter? It is clear that the path to Jerusalem, especially the time around Passover, is not paved with the yellow bricks. It is a really rocky road. And Peter can almost see the people in Jerusalem, the spiritual leaders, all they're already clenching their fists, because that road paved to Jerusalem for Jesus, not with the yellow bricks, but the sharp cutting stones, They already been collecting them. Peter knows them. He knows his rocks. They're collecting the stones in Jerusalem, and they are not into lapidary art, the art of cutting stones. They're in the different kind of business of cutting. Cutting remarks and cutting lives short. Cutting people's lives short. What is Peter the most concerned about? Safety, maybe. Fulfilling personal desires. Of course he does. Who is not concerned about that? Maybe he's not thinking about himself, the success of their endeavor to reinstate the kingdom of Israel. And to make this move right now, when it doesn't seem like the game is nowhere near its end. Just imagine a chess game when one of the players decides, like maybe after three or four moves, to sacrifice a king. Does it make sense? What happens if you sacrifice the king in chess? The game is over. We don't sit down and think and develop strategies when we know of Gethka that the king is going to die, do we? That doesn't work for kingdoms as well. Why would you sacrifice first? What do we do then? It is not safe. It is not smart. It doesn't make any sense. It is completely foolish. The disciples cannot believe themselves. This is a strange feeling. They looked at each other, not understanding, because this is the time they could hardly remember when they ever agreed with Peter. And now they have to agree that they're kind of with him. Jesus, maybe we shouldn't. Maybe it's not time. I mean, it's never time. Why? Peter is picking up the vibe. And what does Peter do? Peter does what, Matthew doesn't say about it, but I can just imagine if this is the beginning of the church, Peter steps up and says, that's right. What are we going to do when we need to make a big decision for the church? What do we do? You've been in the church before, right? What do? We call the business meeting. I call the business meeting in session. We're going to vote. I make a motion that we don't go to Jerusalem. Who's going to second? Judas is going to second. Who's going to vote? Judas, you can put just one hand. We only need two hands. Now, discussion. I mean, it's hard to imagine that Peter uses Robert's Rules of Order to conduct this meeting, but the tension is clearly there because it's Jesus against the disciples. It is Jesus against the common sense. Common sense that expresses the people who love him and who want to follow him. Of course, Peter did not use the rules of order to promote his agenda. And I might have taken some hermeneutical, some interpretive freedom here, but I know that you've been to those meetings when the mission of the church is decided based on common sense and what seems to us humanly possible and safe and sure way. I remember first time I walked into a meeting like this. This was my very first board meeting, 26 years ago. I walked into a conference hall. At that time, Russian churches did not have their buildings, at least in my town. And we were renting like a community center conference room, and I walked in, And I looked at the people sitting around the table, the church board. Have you attended ever a church board? I felt like a bug in a room full of windshields, because the church board was an interview for baptism. Actually, I think it's a disguise, because it was actually spiritual interrogation for about 2 hours. In 1991, in order to be baptized in Russia, you had to take an interview for about 2 hours. The questions, the Bible verses, everything was thrown at you. So, Vadim, you want to become a member of our church, of a Seventh-day Adventist church, and be baptized by water, full immersion. The word full immersion was very important. Baptized by full immersion, the head elder asked. I said, yes, as full as I can get. Push me down. I once had a friend, John Sissel. He was a youth pastor at PUC, and one of Ellen White's granddaughter was getting baptized, and she asked, Pastor John, I really want to make this moment really meaningful. When you put me down under the water, can you just hold me a little bit there? I just want to take a pause. Don't take me right out. He said, sure, I can do that. So he puts granddaughter of Ellen White under the water and holds her. And the PUC church starts getting nervous. And finally, someone says, enough! So he takes you out. Full immersion. What is the most important Adventist text? By that time, I was going to say Psalm 1:1. I was ready. I didn't think that sarcasm would not get me into the water of full immersion. So I said what I was taught to say. The most Adventist text is, can you help me? Revelation 14, 12. We're close. I think we should rebaptize everybody by full immersion. And by immersion, I don't mean water. I mean the whole Adventism doctrinal system. That's what I thought they meant. Of course, Revelation 14:12 is the text that hears the patience of the saints who love the commandments. And you always say, just like when you say baptism by full immersion, when we say commandments, we say including the fourth one. You know, have you been to Russia? You know what I'm talking about. The commandments, including the fourth one, and who have the faith of Jesus. I gave my answer, and everybody nodded their heads. I felt much better. It's nice to feel right, at least for a short moment. And I think that might have just relaxed me a little bit, because we continued the discussion, and I don't know how it got to there. They asked me what was important to you, and I don't know what made me. I don't know why I said it. Maybe I read something before I came in. Some reason I said, the environment in ecology was really important to me. And all of a sudden, I see this stunned look on the people's face, like, what? The same chief interrogator who asked me about the most important question said, no. We're here in the business of saving our souls, not the environment. Oops. Saving our souls. Our mission is to save ourselves, to save our souls. These words were ringing in my head as I walked out of that room. And over the years, like Canadian geese, I keep coming back again, again, and again to this. What is our mission? Is that saving our souls? Because that's what seems to make sense if we look at this through the set of our eyes. But I think the key there is our eyes. I didn't agree at the time that our mission was solely to save our souls. And I did the bravest thing that a candidate for the baptism by full immersion could do. I said nothing. But it's time maybe to say something. Because this is the time when the first and the second motion is on the floor. And Peter is asking to vote. And the discussion takes place. And I just love how Jesus started and ended the discussion. "Get behind me, Satan." What can you say after that? Satan. I have to admit that to us preachers, Peter is truly a gift. Because no matter how much I mess up at the pulpit for the 18 plus years of ministry, I don't think anyone would ever called me Satan. Maybe servant, but not directly. I don't remember, studying preaching a little bit for the last 2 years, I saw multiple syllabi in the homiletical classes that offered the rubrics of preaching, the good sermon, not so good sermon, relevant, not so relevant. But I never saw a rubric that says sermon, checkmark, Satan. So Peter helped us all, because no matter how much I mess up, someone did worse. Satan. Why did Jesus use such a strong words? He wasn't really in the business of walking around calling people names unless they really, really upset him. But what Peter's saying is not that really out of ordinary. It is common sense. Peter points out and says, "Jesus, my common sense positioning system tells me Jerusalem is a bad place to go. It's a wrong road. U-turn. Take the next exit. Go elsewhere where it's safe. Because in Jerusalem, it's really getting stormy there." And I can just see the rocks are being used for making pretty convincing religious arguments. Peter knows his rocks. After all, it says his name. "Get behind me, Satan." I was fascinated by this text. I decided to write a scholarly paper. One thing about scholarly papers, that they are absolutely fun to think about, but absolutely no joy to write. Because it's just thick, it's just you have to go through the stuff. But what's becoming clear that Jesus uses this word Satan that is translated in the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. And Satan in Aramaic, just like in Hebrew, simply means what? Adversary. The opponent that somebody is arguing. And I know the conventional way to look at this text is to say that Jesus indeed called Peter Satan, but it wasn't really, why would he do that, especially in such a reaction? But if we think maybe when Jesus says adversary, and that's what he said in Aramaic, he means just stop arguing with me. Get behind me. And let's say, hold on a second. Get behind me might be a bit of a stretch to mean that follow me. But this is echoing the words of Jesus who called Peter and other disciples, because his line was very simple. It was, come follow me. And one cannot follow someone if you are standing in front. Stop arguing, Peter. Get behind me. Because I am about to go somewhere and do that you don't see and understand. In order for us to fully grasp this moment, we might need to make a little leap into the future. In the next few days, we're going to talk more about what happened on the cross and how it all led to that moment when it happened. But today, I just want to briefly go to this verse, Matthew 27:46. Remember the last words of Jesus. Father, why have you forsaken me? The Jesus experiencing death even before his heart is stopping. This profound disconnect that he's having, he's giving up his life. And all of a sudden we realize what Peter has in mind is good intentions. And Jesus' intent is to give up his life. Theologians would say, well, when we hear Jesus sort of pronouncing disconnect with the Father, what he really means to say and what he really does, he's quoting a famous Psalm 22. Well, no, Psalm 23. But this is Psalm 22. And the opening line from Psalm 22 is, my God, why have you left me all alone? Theologians argued that what Jesus is doing on the cross, he was remembering Psalm 22, the first line, and he begins reciting Psalm 22. This is the beginning of, in words of Walter Brueggemann, an Old Testament theologian, this is the words of disorientation. But the end of the psalm leads to the wonderful praise and assurance in the greatness of God. And some believe that this is what Jesus wanted to do. He wanted to demonstrate that he begins really in a place of despair, but it's going to lead to the praise. It's going to lead to comfort. It's going to lead to hope. But what's fascinating to me is the verse 26 in Psalm 22. Let all those who are suffering, or in other words, poor, let all poor eat and be full. In the very act of personal despair, Jesus is thinking about well-being of people who simply don't have enough food, bringing together charity and spiritual deliverance, making sure that the poor have food and the needy what they lack, the roof, health care, equal respect, and so on. Again, is it a stretch to bring Psalm 22? Maybe, maybe not. Again, preaching on today's day, it gives you some freedom. But I think it all lines up because we see the trajectory and working our way backwards, we arrive to Matthew 25. In Matthew 24 and 25, Jesus talks about the last days, where it's so-called eschatological. It's a fancy, you know, theologians can take a very simple thing and make it really, really sounded like something. Eschatological means last days. So when Jesus reflects, and we all know that what's going to happen in the signs of the last days, the very end, Jesus tells this strange parable about the sheep and the goats. I remember how it goes. That the king comes and gets the sheep on the right hand and the goats on the left, and of course, the sheep and the goats are both surprised that they're on the right and on the left. They're not sure what they're doing. And when Jesus gives explanation, he says, he points out that the service to others as the important part, as perhaps the most important part, he says, caring for others is the most thing. It's what really defines the end of times. It's not having the right kind of doctrines, lining up or building the big buildings or getting the crowds into the buildings. No, he said, it is caring for others. is becoming what defines the people of the end. I assure you that when you haven't done it for one of the least of these, you have done it for me. And they will go away into eternal punishment. Eternal punishment. Disappear. Why? Yes, they didn't help others, but they tried to take care of their own souls, and that doesn't do it, but the righteous ones will go into eternal life. What is completely puzzling here, that neither the sheep nor goat are aware of contingencies of their fate. Living for others and not caring for ourselves seems to be becoming the ultimate rubric in measuring our spirituality. The sheep were serving others without even thinking what they were doing. Caring for all of God's creation that transcends our common sense. Maybe that is the mission that Jesus points out. Maybe it's that destination to which His road leads. Whatever it is, our mission is not saving ourselves. Maybe this is a good point for us to start wrapping our minds about what it is for us to follow Jesus. What it is for us, and what it is for us to hear His voice from the cross, acknowledging the devastation of death. We typically look at the death of Jesus as a punishment. We say we sinned, and Paul tells us so many words, and there are many different ideas why Jesus died, and of course one of the most common, it's this punishment thing that it has to be me on the cross for what I have done. And sure it is. But one of the things that I am realizing about my nature is no matter how much I'm trying to help others, there's always an element of selfishness in me. And any time I help, I kind of think, I hope it's not you. But in every act of charity that we do humanly, would you agree there are a few things there that we pride ourselves? It may be sin. Sin can be defined as this ever-presence, ubiquitous presence of self-interest in everything we do, even in serving and helping others. How do we then reconcile? How can we truly give ourselves? How, remember the little pig, how do we really consider a major sacrifice if no matter what we do, we always reserve a little bit for ourselves? Because we like yellow bricks. We don't like rocky roads to Jerusalem. And maybe the death of Jesus on the cross and His experience, it's a gift to us that we can experience death even to our own personal ambitions and self-centeredness. Paul reminds us in 1 Corinthians 15:31, brothers and sisters, I swear by the pride I have in you, in Jesus Christ our Lord, I'm facing death every day. In other words, Christ's death is not only punishment for our sin, but maybe if sin is what prevents us from giving ourselves fully to others and vice versa, receiving it as a gift, the death of Jesus is a gift that empowers us to overcome our natural egoistic self-centeredness, living for ourselves and saving our souls, all for a good cause of common sense and safety, and gives us a chance to live for others. Does this make sense? The cross of Jesus. It does. And it doesn't. But whatever we see, whatever we hear from the cross, I hope we hear Paul's words, for the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. 1 Corinthians 1:18. Foolishness. My friend Steve, your very own Steve Hemingway, blew my mind with a simple reflection. When we talked about the sheep and the goats, he said, isn't it interesting that on the cross, it is not the sound of a dying sheep, but the death of a shepherd that shatters the common sense of the universe. Can you hear the shepherd's voice on the cross? Can you hear that voice? What is our mission? Might be a silly question, but I suppose there are some benefits on preaching on the April Fool's Day.